Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Coming up,
it's been a real honor and pleasure and treasure to be sworn in by the first female House Speaker. Thank you so much.
That was Congresswoman Nikki Tsongas when she was first sworn in a decade ago. She joins us today to talk about her congressional career. Also today, science writer Abby Norman has endometriosis, but it took her years to convince doctors that her pain was real.
How could something this bad that looks like this, that doesn't look like it should be in your body, how can that not be a big deal?
And sports with Bill Littlefield. We'll talk Celtics and their win over Philly. Plus, why is Tom Brady being so coy?
I plead the fifth.
That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. And we're going to start today with Congresswoman Nikki Tsongas. She joins us in the studio as part of our ongoing series of conversations with members of the Massachusetts delegation. Tsongas represents the state's 3rd district. And as you probably know by now, she has announced that she is not running for re-election. So this is something of an exit interview as well. Congresswoman Tsongas, welcome back to the show. And thanks for coming into the studio.
Thank you. It's good to be here, even though it's 80 degrees out there and I'm sure you don't know it.
Yeah, because it's about 64 in here. I'm always cold in our studio, but I guess we have to keep the equipment cool. Before we get to sort of the exit interview type questions, there still are matters of import that you're dealing with every day. And I just want to let's talk about some of them. Let's start with what's been going on at the top of the Department of Veterans Affairs and the lack of a VA secretary right now. I mean, just in the past week, we saw Rear Admiral Ronnie Jackson withdrawing his nomination after allegations from current and former colleagues of an abusive work environment and handing out prescription drugs, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, what's your reaction to the turmoil at the top of the VA right now?
Well, bottom line is we need a VA that serves well those who served us. And I think in recent times we've seen too many stories, one about the turmoil just in terms of leadership, one in terms of the turmoil within the bureaucracy of the VA not really doing its job to the degree that we would want. So that's the bottom line. We need a VA that serves well those who've served us. And there is work to be done. And we need a leader at the top who is up to that challenge, who brings that commitment to the VA and helps bring some stability to it so that we can solve the problems that we're all too well aware of.
Yeah. So the VA serves, what, 9 million at least veterans plus their family members as well. It's the second largest bureaucratic organization in the federal government. It's a hugely important organization here. I mean, there's so many challenges that the VA faces. We definitely do not have time to get into them all. But, you know, one of the core things, which is one of the reasons why former VA Secretary Shulkin says he was pushed out, is that this tension over if and how much of the VA services should be privatized, right? Like put the community care, expanding the community care programs. I'm just wondering what your take is on that.
Well, we created the Choice Act, which gave an opportunity for veterans who were waiting too long in line to get care just because in some instances the system was overwhelmed. In other instances, the veterans were located in places where the VA just wasn't adequately present through long-time decisions. So that act was created to give veterans an option. And we have to make sure that that is working and working well. But the other thing I find, I've made a good number of visits to the Bedford VA. for a number of reasons, but in one instance, just to make sure that our female veterans were getting the care that they needed and deserved as well. And what I find is that many of our veterans just feel more comfortable in a VA setting. So the answer is not simply to privatize VA's health care. The answer is to get that health care, which the VA provides through its hospitals, that it's doing it. It's up to the task. People don't have to wait in line. Once in line and within the VA system, they're getting the care that they are needed. There are some things the VA does so very well. There are other things that it needs a lot of help with. But that's just one aspect of it. But again, as I say, so often I hear from veterans, they want to be in a place where the physicians and the support staff understand the veteran experience. It's unique. It's not something that those of us who've never served might understand. And that is a comfort that our veterans seek as well as the medical care they need.
Yeah. And I mean, speaking to the medical care, oftentimes veterans' medical needs are highly complex given the nature of the injuries they sustain, you know, in various fields of battle. So,
and it's true. I mean, we sort of have an influx of veterans, those who are coming back from these recent wars and have the particular injuries and traumas associated with that. But we also have an aging population of veterans who are coming in more for health issues associated with that aging process. So it's really a double whammy, but it's something that, given the scale of the bureaucracy, we should be up to if we put the right leadership in place.
Yeah. So one more thing about new leadership at the VA. I mean, you are on the House Committee for Armed Services, and one of the names that's being floated around now as a possible new nominee is that of former Florida Congressman, Republican Jeff Miller, who was also on Armed Services until he retired from his congressional seat in 2016. I suppose more importantly, he's the former chairman of the House Veterans Affairs Committee. I mean, so you worked with him for a time on Armed Services. His name's being floated. What do you think?
Well, what I know is what starts in the active duty ends up in the VA. So for those of us who've been on the Armed Services Committee, our focus has been, especially through the Military Personnel Subcommittee, making sure that we're adequately preparing those who serve, we're adequately protecting them with the equipment they need to minimize the injury that they sustain, and to just anticipate what their injuries might be and to do everything we can to protect and prevent. And, for example, all my work on military sexual assault has been around that, because to the degree we fail to do that or do it in a lesser way than it should be, it makes its way into the VA, where it has a follow-on consequences. So Mr. Miller certainly knows all that we've done on the active duty side, and I think in his role on the VA committee, he should well know what we're doing well and what we're not doing well. And I think the real challenge would be in the questions that would ask, is he up to managing a bureaucracy of this particular scale, given the issues that are currently present within it?
Yeah, I mean, President Trump basically said he believes no one has the experience previously to manage a bureaucracy of the size of the VA. I mean, perhaps he's got a point there. I mean, but what was former Congressman Miller like to work with on Armed Services?
Well, I have to say that we didn't serve on the same subcommittees together,
I can't
give you any personal insight beyond just knowing what his experiences would have been on those two committees.
And the work from one committee flows to the next. Okay. Well, you did mention your ongoing work and advocacy around military sexual assault. So let's talk about that, because the Defense Department released its annual report on sexual assault in the military. And I just wonder what you make, first of all, of the fact that according to this annual report, sexual assaults are up in the United States military from roughly 6,000 in fiscal year 2016 to more than 6,700 in 2017.
Well, it tells us we have more work to do, that the work is never done. I know one of the things we did early on was insist upon this survey so that we would really get a full sense of the depth and breadth of the problem. And one of the challenge, and so this survey has helped us to monitor, really, are these reforms working? If they're not, give us some sense of what more may need to be done. So we are having, I hope, a more honest, an honest sense of really how our reforms are working or not. But as I said, it's clear we have more work yet to do. And it's concerning. It's simply concerning. I'd like to hope that some of those reports are indicative of the fact that survivors are now more willing to come forward because they trust the system to deal with them in a fair-minded way. But I'm not confident of that. Too many of these instances have not gone to trial in a way that you would like to see. So that tells you there's still some shortcomings in the process under the Uniform Code of Justice that we still have work to do.
So let me just ask you about that, because maybe you can help clarify something then, because the report found that in more than 60%, 62% of cases in the last fiscal year, that there was enough evidence for the DOD to pursue disciplinary action. Does that mean that they did, or that there was enough evidence, and in some cases they did, and in others they didn't?
Well, disciplinary action may mean a number of things. It may not mean judicial action. And so commanders are empowered to take certain actions, even if a court proceeding does not move forward. So my goal, though, would be to see the transparency and openness that comes with a full-throated judicial proceeding, and so that appropriate punishments are meted out in a way that is satisfying to the survivor.
So tell me, what other steps do you still think need to be taken within the military to, you know, get, again, a better handle on this problem? Because it's still a major challenge.
Well, we've done good things. You know, for example, we first learned that survivors were not necessarily well served by the prosecution, that their interests did not necessarily align. And so we created something called a Special Victims Council. And this was an attorney who was aligned solely with the survivor's interests, could help navigate them through the process, encourage them to follow through on all that was required, and be at their side. And I think that that has had good impact. We learned early on in the process that even if you went forward with a court proceeding and a alleged assailant was found guilty, that a commander could overturn a jury verdict of guilty. And we eliminated that right of the commander. So commanders can no longer overturn the jury verdict of guilty in those crimes or any other serious crime. So those were important steps forward. But I think we keep coming back to the initial role the commander has as a gatekeeper, and whether or not they should continue to serve that function and decide what the best way forward is. And I think that's where the debate has settled. There hasn't been a consensus around it. I have been supportive of eliminating that gatekeeper function, but we've yet to get to a majority willing to do so. And I would suggest that as these numbers continue to hold, even if they don't go up significantly, if they don't go down significantly, it tells us we still have a real problem, and maybe inevitably it comes down to that particular right and responsibility of the commander that it needs to be stripped away.
I see. Well, let's just move on to foreign relations, foreign policy, just for a quick second here, mostly because, I mean, we could talk about Iran, but in fact, I'm more curious about what you make of the progress that we've been seeing on the Korean Peninsula. I mean, we had that historic meeting between leaders of North and South Korea, the first time a leader of North Korea has stepped foot in South Korea. I mean, this is happening under the Trump administration. What do you think?
Well, I think I'm skeptical, but I would like to be hopeful. I think it was a telling moment for, and certainly great theater, to see the leaders of South Korea and North Korea sort of mutually step back and forth across the DMZ line. Yeah. And so it holds out promise, and I think it has
to be pursued.
We have
been here before, too.
But we have been
here.
Two
other times, at least, I can
count. We have been here before, and we know that. But if there's a way forward that allows us to walk away from the precipice of war in a situation, in a geography, that means there will be millions of people potentially losing their lives, too many Americans currently located there, I think we have to pursue these opportunities as they arise with great skepticism, but not unhopefully.
Yeah. One more thing, dollars and cents, because I just wonder what you make of the newest federal budget here. It does add significantly to the debt, several hundred billion dollars. And it's just, it's an ongoing challenge here in the United States. But what do you think?
Well, it's always a concern when you're presented with a budget that in which you don't pay for the dollars you're spending. And that was the budget that was presented with us. There is continued and further investment on the defense side of the aisle. But the thing that we on the other side were always arguing for and I think achieved was so robust expenditures on the non-defense side so that we can put the dollars we need into opioids. We can put the dollars we need into community health centers. We can help find ways to support young people as they're seeking access to higher education, help reduce some of the debt burden for them. So there were good things on the non-defense side that we had to fight hard for. And there are investments on the defense side that are much needed, given our longstanding wars. That being said, we need to find a way to pay for these. And we don't find a way to pay for them when we're enacting tax cuts that, again, disproportionately benefit the top 1% of Americans, in which 83% of the benefit goes to those who lead it least and have a sort of disappearing tax cut for most everybody else. So they don't happen in isolation. They happen in concert. And as we enact the tax reform legislation, it really puts at risk as well the fundamental safety net for all Americans, which is Social Security and Medicare. Yeah. So much to be concerned about. And these are the kinds of debates that will be ongoing as we move our way through this election cycle and into the next year.
We wanted to ask you about the budget because we were remembering a little earlier today that your late husband, Paul Tsongas, of course, he was quite committed to getting the national debt on a sustainable course.
And we saw the impact. Yeah. Yes, he did. And, and Bill Clinton, listened.
We had
listened
a surplus,
well,
right?
Listened well to Paul and went on to put in place a budget that led to a surplus, which was quickly dissipated under President Bush, and obviously we've seen with the economic crisis that President Obama had to confront. But nevertheless, I think we did it in a responsible way, and we were working our way out of it. And now with the Trump administration in concert with a GOP-controlled House and Senate, you see a tax reform bill, not just the budget, but the tax reform bill.
It's a trillion and a half
dollars.
Yeah.
Egregious in its impact, and will inevitably lead to an attack on, as I said, our basic social net, social safety net.
Well, we are speaking with Congresswoman Nikki Tsongas, and Congresswoman Tsongas, in the last, six, seven, 8 minutes that we have here, I'm wondering how you feel about, now that it's been several months since you announced that you're not going to run for re-election, that you're retiring from congressional service. How do you feel about that decision now?
I feel a little bittersweet. But I haven't second-guessed my decision, I have to say. I still feel these decisions are, in the end, very, very personal. I still feel that it was the right thing to do at the right time. I've been around long enough to know that there's a time for beginnings and a time for endings. And it was clear that I've been so fortunate to spend 10 years, it'll be 11 years in office by the time we come to this end of this year, through some pretty remarkable times that I could not have fully imagined. In fact, I don't think I could have imagined them at all as I was first seeking this seat.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, have learned
firsthand.
Such as,
do you have an example? You have 10 years worth of experiences now, high points, low points.
Well, I could not have imagined the Great Recession, for example, that we were just on the cusp of that free fall that I saw devastated so many across this country, but certainly in my district, and we're just finally building our way out of it. But there are lingering impacts of that. I couldn't have imagined, I don't think, and I'm grateful that I was able to be part of the historic repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, and the Supreme Court decision that created marriage equality for all Americans, regardless of sexual identity. So that are historic moments, or that I would be on the floor when we would finally pass the Affordable Care Act, which expanded access to health care for millions of Americans. And these are moments that never go away, absolutely. And I feel very privileged to have been a part of that. And to have been part of a Congress and a presidency that saw these openings and felt it was the right thing to do for this country.
Yeah, but on the other hand, let me ask you, were there ever times, honestly, were there ever times where, we've, for 10 years now, more than that, we've seen the rise of this partisan rancor in Washington, especially in the House, right? And I just want, were there ever times where maybe where you're just sitting at your desk in your office and you just wanted to put your hands in your heads and you think, what am I doing here? Getting stuff done is just, it's harder than it should be.
It is harder on the big things. And that's because, we reflect a country. Each of us comes from our little piece of this country, but we bring the values and beliefs of those we're representing, and those are deep, and they're worthy of maybe a more polite discussion, but they're for real in people's lives, and we have to pay attention to it. But at the same time, I was fortunate to be on the Armed Services Committee, where has a great tradition of bipartisanship, where you're not automatically excluded from the conversation if you happen to be a member of the minority party, so that we're able to come together and do make the investments we think are appropriate to protect this country, protect those serving. And as a result, have seen real success on this issue of sexual assault in the military and the role of women in the military, because it was really a dual-fold emphasis that I was focused on, because I always felt, you know, if you can change this honored institution, even with all of its black marks, then inevitably maybe you can change a country. So around the role of women in the military and how we need to be sure that they are not victimized by their own. These are important conversations we're having as a country, even in the Me Too movement, for example.
Oh, but let me ask you. So I am inspired by hearing you say that if you can change an institution like the military, perhaps you can change the country. But
not overnight.
Yeah. I mean, I was thinking like the president of the United States right now, we still have a tape of him admitting essentially to assaulting women, and he's still the president of the United States, and he has rock solid support of at least 35% of, you know, the voting members of his party. It didn't change all that much.
Well, when I first got to Congress, I had a member of Congress come up to me. It was with a woman from Northern California, and she said, the thing that I had to get used to was that it takes time to bring change. But if you don't start the conversation and if you don't start pushing the agenda, change will never come. So for all those young people who might possibly be out there listening to a little smidgen of this as they are looking at things that they feel need to be changed in this country, I would call on them to say you need to get involved. It doesn't happen without people being in places where they can assert whatever authority or power they have to push these changes. So yeah. I've been in that position on the Armed Services Committee. I'm grateful for it. I think there are people in many other places pushing for it in their own way. You just have to think of the brave survivors that are coming forward through some of the Me Too stories, that these are not easy conversations. Mm-hmm. And just this week, I had three family members who were part of their family's military service come to me with other stories about what the military isn't doing. And they were really tough stories, but they're not unlike stories you might hear outside of the military. But it takes the bravery of those people to open our eyes to what we need to do for those of us who are fortunate to be elected to office.
It sounds like part of you is going to miss the work.
I think I will. Yeah. I will. I think I will. But I'm glad to see that somehow or rather, the 13 people who are running on the Democratic side.
It's like a free-for-all in the third all of a sudden.
But they saw something good in this and the possibilities of this office. And they have put their hats in the ring, and they're, you know, out there making the case, which is something we all do once elected and then seeking to be reelected. It's never over.
Care to give us a hint about who you might be throwing your considerable political weight behind? I mean, 13 candidates. Well not all of them are Democrats, of course.
Those are all the Democrats.
Oh, those are the Democrats.
Those are all
oh my
the Democrats.
God.
There's one Republican.
Forgive me. I cannot actually keep track of it. I apologize.
I am so proud of the diversity. There's five women who are running. I think that's a sign of the changing times in and of itself. It's a field that is diverse in every way, and I'm so proud that people of and tremendous talent. I'm so proud of the fact that people of such talent have see public service and elective office as a way to make a difference.
I'm waiting to hear a name.
There's no name.
Okay.
There's no name. Yeah, but they are great. They're a great group.
Well, Congresswoman Nikki Tsongas, she represents Massachusetts' 3rd District through the end of this term for her. Congresswoman Tsongas, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you so very much for coming in.
Thank you, Meghna. It's nice to be with you.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's not uncommon for women in pain to be met with doubt about their condition, sometimes from the very medical community that's meant to help them. Science writer Abby Norman describes this phenomenon and her own experiences with chronic illness, and it's because she suffers from endometriosis. It's a chronic disorder that occurs when uterine-like cells grow outside of the uterus. But for years, Norman struggled to find treatment, or even the words sometimes, to describe the pain she was feeling to her doctors. She writes about this in her very well-researched new book. It's called Ask Me About My Uterus, A Quest to Make Doctors Believe a Woman's Pain. Abby Norman, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you so much for having me.
So I think the subtitle of your book, Abby, is going to strike a chord with at least half our listeners. I mean, is it that doctors don't believe in women's pain?
It's an incredibly complex issue, and it's one that is not just about whether or not it's believed in the medical setting, but sort of whether or not it's believed at even a much broader sociocultural setting. And I mean that in the sense that other people in a woman's life might, you know, in some way challenge what she's saying. But also, I think more importantly, that before a woman ever goes into a doctor's office, there is a tendency to perhaps even doubt herself and her own experience.
Mm. Now, one of the things that led you to explore this was endometriosis, right? Can you tell us a little bit about why that played such a huge role in your life?
Yeah. So, and of course, it's always this way. But in retrospect, I realized that from the very first period I ever had, I had a terrible, terrible time with menstruation. And like many young women, I think I was set up to feel that having pain or other symptoms or just feeling really miserable was actually kind of normal. It really wasn't until I was a sophomore in college, so I was 19, and I had a more acute and quite serious and seemingly sudden situation that I kind of started to realize that maybe it wasn't normal, and that more importantly, it wasn't just that I didn't really know what a normal period would have been like, but that actually nobody really does.
Yeah. So let me just jump in here, because that terrible bout of pain that you had when you were 19, is that the one where you ended up in the emergency room and you were handed the pain scorecard and you weren't quite sure how to characterize your pain?
Yeah. So I was a sophomore in college. I was at Sarah Lawrence, and I was just completely struck down by this sort of abdominal pelvic pain. And actually, I waited several days, if not a week, to go to the emergency room. And part of that was because that whole idea of kind of trying to downplay it. And so when I finally did go, I was confronted with this pain scale, which is that whole like rate your pain on a scale of 1 to 10 thing. And this is something that I talk about in the book fairly early on, because it's something that is even still quite confounding to me, of how difficult and near impossible it has been for science to provide sort of a quantified pain measure. And part of that is because pain is inherently subjective.
I was going to say the experience of it can be very subjective, or is subjective, yeah.
Yeah, even within the same person, even within your own lifetime, your experience of pain will change quite a bit.
So this brings us to a reading, if you could, do from the book here, because it's a passage where you write about the suffering that you experience that goes along with having endometriosis, and also as to why you begin to write this book in the first place. So I was wondering if you could do that reading for us.
Yeah, sure thing. It's true that those suffering from endometriosis haven't lost all their hair from chemotherapy or taken on that gray hue of a person with a terminal illness. They are not wheelchair-bound or using a cane. And they may well get up every day, wash their hair, put on makeup, get dressed, and go to work. But they do suffer, likely far more than even those closest to them know, especially in the moments when they are alone and can let their guard down. For me, it was usually in my car that I felt safe to fall apart, where I hid away to nap or fend off a bad wave of nausea. I'm sure everyone has their own place to escape to or to sequester themselves where they can suffer privately. Lonely places that swallow the sounds, smells, and sights of pain, sucking the proof right out of the marrow, washing it away so that not even a filmy residue remains. It would be noble of me to say that I started writing about my experiences because I wanted to reach out and help, but that impetus came later. At the beginning, I was writing purely as a means to understand my own grief. When I started yelling into the void of the internet, I was startled when it began to whisper back.
Well, that's Abby Norman reading from her new book, Ask Me About My Uterus, A Quest to Make Doctors Believe in Women's Pain. Began to whisper back. Tell me more about that.
So when the book came out, I knew that it was going to resonate on some level just because I had so many, you know, emails or messages from women all over the world. But in the last month or so, what has been so compelling to me is not so much the number, but the consistency of the stories. Mm-hmm. I mean, now I'm at the point where I'm getting messages that are exactly the same. And it's like, you know,
what are those messages saying?
When they read the story, they go, I have had this exact conversation with a doctor. Actually, I've had this exact conversation with three or four or five doctors. And yet these conversations where they're told that it's all in their head or they're making it up or they're not dealing with their stress adequately or, you know, maybe they need to do yoga,
Here? Because I'm curious about whether or not those responses that women get from doctors, is it because, you know, again, the doctors just generally discount or don't believe in the women and the pain they're experiencing? Or is it because, you know, for a number of different reasons, we actually don't have enough or adequate, you know, medical science yet on women's bodies?
Oh, it is absolutely both of these things. And this is what I mean when I say this is an incredibly complex issue. There's so much about the reproductive system that we don't know just at a basic level in terms of like how things should go if things are okay. So on one level, it is an issue of just there not being adequate research. And then beyond that, you can see this reflected more broadly in our social cultural landscape. For most of the history of medicine, it's largely been not just, you know, sort of directed by men, but also medical education has and continues to be primarily sort of written and, you know, taught by men. So there you have this much broader issue that goes back and for which there is a precedent that is very long.
Well, Abby, as I've said, your book is incredibly researched and there are so many parts of it which are surprising to say the least. I wonder if you could just take us way, way back when we're talking about just sort of how the medical establishment viewed women and women's bodies. I mean, the wandering womb theory, what is that?
Yeah. So, I mean, if you go back through medical history all the way back to like Hippocrates, I mean, even the ancient Greeks, there was this idea that the womb was actually something in terms of an organ that could move. And that this would cause any number of constitutional and, more importantly, psychological symptoms in women. And so this idea that the womb, whether or not it could actually move or whether or not it had like a mind of its own, the idea that the womb was sort of the central troublemaker for a woman, regardless of where her physical or mental issues were and what constituted them, there's a really incredibly long precedent that was set for this characterization that they could be driven to any number of physical ailments by their reproductive system.
Yeah. So I wonder, I mean, we're only really scratching the surface of again, how deeply researched your book is, because there's so much we could talk about here. But I'm running out of time here. And I just wonder, I'd love to hear from you what you think about sort of how we continue to take steps forward on this for women and how the medical establishment takes them and their pain seriously. I mean, is there some hope, for example, that I'm seeing here that in December of last year, the Association of American Medical Colleges said that for the first time, the number of women enrolling in U.S. medical schools exceeded the number of men. They were 50.7% of matriculants in 2017. So just a tiny bit over half. I mean, there are already a lot of great women doctors out there, but could this make a difference?
I really hope it does. And I think that one of the things that really needs to change is that so many of the issues that we're dealing with as it pertains to these types of issues really come down from the administrative level. They come from not necessarily even from the clinical level, because I've certainly had female doctors who have sort of treated me in the same way.
Exactly,
because medicine itself is what is so patriarchally structured. And really, that even happens in terms of, you know, initial medical education and also continuing medical education. So there really needs to be a shift sort of at that higher level. But as that shift begins to happen, and as some of the people who have perpetuated these sort of, you know, really unhelpful and actually quite damaging sort of attitudes about this issue, you know, as they sort of, you know, move into retirement, we have a turnover, if you will. I hope that that helps. But I also hope that even in the meantime, that the physicians that are in practice at multiple levels just begin to really actively and thoughtfully engage. And I have to tell you that one of the best things that has happened to me since this book came out, I had this doctor tweet me, and he said, you know, I had a patient come in today, and she told me that she was reading your book, and I had the pleasure of telling her that I was too. And that meant so much, because that sort of, you know, example of willingness and opening that conversation, opening that dialogue, I mean, that's where the hope is, I think.
Well, Abby Norman is a science writer in Maine, and her new book is Ask Me About My Uterus, A Quest to Make Doctors Believe in Women's Pain. Abby, thank you so very much.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
And I was wondering if any of this rings true for you. Have you had a tough time convincing your doctor about your pain? Or if you're a doctor on the other side of that equation, what has that been like for you? Send us a tweet at Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back. It's Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. A group of New England senators, including Massachusetts Senators Ed Markey and Elizabeth Warren, want the U.S. government to speed up an analysis of what Canada is doing to help protect the endangered North American right whale. And if Canada's rules aren't as strong as the United States, well, this group of senators wants the U.S. to consider taking trade action. Reporter Fred Bever has this story on how the issue is causing anxiety for the fishing industry on both sides of the border.
The right whale's numbers have dropped to only 450 following an unprecedented spate of dead whales found in Canada's Gulf of St. Lawrence last year. The senators say U.S. fishermen have made big sacrifices to reduce impacts on the whales. Now they're calling on the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration to investigate whether fishermen in Canada are being held to similar standards. And if not, they say, then NOAA should consider barring the import of Canadian seafood from the relevant fisheries.
You know, it's really a double-edged sword.
Patrice McCarron is executive director of the Maine Lobstermen's Association. She says Maine's lobster harvesters do not relish the prospect of a trade dispute with their neighbors to the north.
That is a very big hammer to use, but given the fact that we have, you know, media report after media report threatening that this whale species can go extinct and our fishery potentially could be shut down because of that, I think it does rise to the level that we have to have all options on the table.
McCarron acknowledges that the two countries' fisheries are interdependent. Because the Canadian lobster harvest is strongest in winter and the U.S. harvest is strongest in summer, together they keep the world supplied with American lobster year-round, and they keep cross-border market infrastructures humming. And that's why the Maine Lobster Dealers Association is opposing the senator's approach.
There is a very complicated and intricate supply chain that happens beyond the boat and beyond the dock.
Annie Salikas is executive director of the Dealers Association. She says the industry depends on consistent supply and on smooth avenues for trade.
In the absence of both of those things, it's very difficult for lobster businesses to maintain their markets and their customer base. And so the ripple effect of an issue like this would be massive for lobster companies in Maine.
Most right whale deaths are attributed to entanglements with fishing ropes and buoys or ship strikes. Since 12 whales turned up dead in the Gulf of St. Lawrence last year, Canadian fishery regulators have taken action, including new gear requirements for New Brunswick's growing snow crab fishery and moving its season around in an effort to get rope out of the water before the whales might show up. In the letter, its author, Massachusetts Senator Ed Markey, applauds Canada's actions, but he also says he's concerned it's not enough. And in Canada, the prospect of a shutout from American markets has rattled government officials.
The closure of access to that market would be the biggest single devastating thing that could happen to the Canadian fish and seafood industry.
Canadian Federal Fisheries Minister Dominic LeBlanc recently told crab fishermen that the stakes require the most protective conservation action possible. And he noted that U.S. regulators are responding dynamically to the whales' movements here, actions Canada will need to follow up on.
Because there were upwards of 90 right whales that were spotted off the coast of Massachusetts, the Americans decided to delay the opening of a lobster season. Those right whales, make no mistake about it, are heading north.
The letter was co-signed by senators from New Hampshire, Connecticut, New York, and New Jersey. Maine's Senate delegation was notably absent from the signature list. In a joint statement, Senators Angus King and Susan Collins say NOAA should use diplomacy to ensure the rigor of Canada's standards, but if that fails, then a formal investigation of Canada's fishery regulations should be accelerated. They stopped short, however, of supporting potential trade action.
Well, that story from reporter Fred Bever. All right, it's Wednesday, which means Bill Littlefield graces us with his presence in the Radio Boston studio.
That's
hello,
such a gentle
Bill.
Sting into sports. That was very
Oh, should
sweet.
We have, like, I don't know, like blaring trumpets?
Talk about figure skating or something.
No. But before I forget, I mean, not that we wouldn't
yeah.
if figure skating
just
was in
time.
The news this week, but before I forget, let me just remind folks, because not that they need it, but that Bill Littlefield is host of NPR's Only a Game. So, okay, well, let's start with a little more vigorous sports noise. How about some happy noise from the Celtics on Monday?
Here's Rozier again. Why not? Game one win to the house here, 117-101.
All right, great. 117-101 against Philly, but it's just the first of seven.
That's the issue. Yeah, I the Celtics looked absolutely wonderful. And that is especially incredible given the number of injuries they've sustained throughout the year. And then, of course, most recently in that game. And the 76ers couldn't throw a rock into the ocean. They were awful.
Oh my God.
I do not think they will be as cooperative for the rest of the series in terms of throwing up bricks from all over, and especially from three-point land. They're a pretty good three-point shooting team, and they simply could not find the range at all. Missed a lot of open shots. So you give credit to the Celtics for playing very good defense, especially in spurts, and for doing what they needed to do to get the ball in the basket. But the 76ers looked like the 6 days off that they earned by making fairly short work of the opposition in their first series did not do them any good. They might have been better off playing a six-game or seven-game series and not being quite
well,
so rusty.
Now you're making me feel like the Celts should have won by like 30 or 40 points. But we'll see what happens tomorrow night, though, right?
That's quite a gap, 16 points in a final series. You know, look at the Cavaliers. They needed overtime to win the first game in their series last night.
Okay. So. And as I know you've said before, on Only a Game in Here, all it takes is one, right? And like ultimately you win, even if it's just by one. It's a win.
1 point does it.
Okay. So again, so we'll see what happens tomorrow tomorrow night for game two there. Let's move on to the Bruins. They play to Tampa Bay tonight at 7. They lost to Tampa Bay on Monday 4-2. Just an off night there for the Bruins, or maybe an indication of where
Tampa,
things are going?
Well, Tampa finished ahead of them in the regular season standings, so you can't really... You know, the Bruins are a favorite tonight because they're playing at home, and I am a firm believer that the home ice advantage in hockey is greater than, say, the home court advantage in basketball, simply
Why?
Because hockey fans make so much noise. And they get so excited. And, you know, they're rooting for all kinds of things besides goals, like fights. And
now, did you say the Tampa Bay came out ahead of the Bruins?
Yeah,
they were in the regular season?
First. The Bruins were in second in the Atlantic Division.
In terms of their head-to-heads over the regular season, the Bruins won more.
Yeah, which means approximately nothing.
You
have to look at all of the long season. You have to look at travel. You have to look at who's injured and who's not playing well and all the rest of it. So I was talking to somebody about this earlier. It's true of both hockey and basketball, the NHL and the NBA both, that there really is a certain amount of sense to starting to pay attention at a whole nother level when they get to the postseason. Uh-huh. Because you really get the feeling that the players do that. And so why shouldn't the fans do that as well? Just a non-Boston issue. But people talked about how the Cavaliers didn't look nearly as strong, blah, 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 this year. And maybe that'll happen. Maybe they won't make it to the finals this time around. But, LeBron James gets him to overtime the other night, and then you can turn the TV off because he's going to win in overtime. even though the other team looked better for 98% of the game. It's the playoffs are different.
Okay.
And the intensity level is different. So I don't know.
So what are we supposed to do is snooze through the first half of every regular season?
Yeah, the first half, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, pay attention to catching up on your reading and
read a book, Bill right. Littlefield says.
So much for 38 years, season ticket holders.
Okay, that's true.
English it was, if I recall.
All right. I know that it's not football season here for the NFL, but let's talk.
It's always football season. That's the astonishing thing about the NFL. They have made it always football season. People get all excited about the draft.
The draft is the spectacle of the draft.
Where they pick players who nobody knows whether they'll be any good for at least a couple of years when they finally get...
They do know how to sell a good show.
Yes, I absolutely agree
with you on that. But I'm going to talk about Tom Brady for a second because he did an interview on Monday at the Milken Institute Global Conference in Beverly Hills.
And he wishes he hadn't.
Well, because he was asked whether he feels appropriate gratitude from Robert Kraft and Bill Belichick. And here's what Tom Brady said.
I plead the fifth.
Athletes should not make jokes.
What was going on there?
I have no idea. I really have no idea. The only thing I can think is if there was any substance at all behind that quip, it may be that Tom Brady is now far enough along in his career so that he's recognizing that at the point where he can no longer be a very effective quarterback, his value will very quickly sink to nothing, and he will be in the Hall of Fame, and he will be widely respected by people who talk about great quarterbacks of all time, but he will be of no further use to Mr. Belichick or Mr. Kraft.
That's the business of
the
game.
Exactly. But
his last contract was $41 million.
Exactly.
In
America, that is a significant gesture of appreciation. The other thing is, athletes are no different from the rest of us in one respect, and that is that probably none of us ever feel we're sufficiently appreciated. We know everything.
For 99% of folks, that probably is true.
Yeah, well, we know everything from the inside of our own head and the inside of our own heart, and we know how dedicated we are to the things that we're trying to do as well as we can do them, and we don't probably think that other people quite understand the depth of our dedication and hard work. And, of course, that's very silly, but the human condition is a very silly condition. So that's how it is.
You were such a
compassionate man. I can say this kind of stuff now. It's such fun.
With all due respect to Tom Brady, I am not feeling that same level of compassion as you are. But anyway, so...
He's also, his wife says he's been hitting the head a lot.
Well, yes. Okay.
Nobody else will acknowledge that. But
bringing us back down to serious issues... in sports. I mean, that's a good point. That's a good point. Okay, so let's, since you talked about getting hit in the head, I want to just, in a couple, last couple minutes we have here, Bill, let's talk about the new developments in ongoing studies over CTE, of course. Those are the injuries, brain injuries suffered from folks playing high-impact sports a lot. And the Globe recently reported that former NFL players suffering from brain injuries, including some former Patriots, are seeking help from a healthcare entrepreneur, Larry Burns, and he's helped former players gain millions of dollars in the NFL's worker compensation and disability programs. What's going on here?
Well, I think what's going on is the players to whom you're referring are desperate. They don't feel they're getting the help they need from the National Football Association, National Football League. And so this guy says, I can help you. I can put you up. I can get you money to which you're entitled. I've got some medical you know, procedures that
I've
are
also got
help
a
you.
Rap sheet.
Yeah, the guy's been arrested any
felony
number of
fraud
times.
Conviction.
He's a felon, and he's been in prison. But if you're desperate and you get headaches all the time and you can't remember your children's names, maybe you go to anybody who says, don't worry about a thing. I can get you some assistance, and you'll feel better, and I can get you some money. Because any offer is better than what some of these guys have encountered so far, which is an awful lot of bureaucracy and not much help.
I mean, so, okay, you were just saying, we were just talking a minute ago about Tom Brady feeling underappreciated, perhaps. I mean, what about these guys?
Well, this is the crazy world that the National Football League has created, that they are very, very, the best of them and the luckiest of them who have long careers are very, very highly compensated. But how much do you have to be compensated to make up for the fact that your brain doesn't work very well many, many, many years earlier than would be the case with somebody who hasn't gotten hit in the head a lot?
Wow. Well, Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game, which airs right here on WBUR every Saturday at 7 a.m. and 7 p.m., a compassionate journalist, to say the least. Bill, thank you so very much.
You're very welcome. My pleasure.
That's it for today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.